And the purpose of the meeting tonight is to have a discussion first with some people from the Department of Revenue that are going to go through a brief but pretty thorough explanation of the assessing process and then how the results of that process impact property taxes on each individual property. So at that point, we hope that everyone will get a general understanding of it. We do have one of the more complicated property tax systems in the country, so they're going to do the best they can with a very complicated system. Then we will take testimony from the public, and one of the purposes of this meeting is to get public input on how we can improve the process, especially truth in taxation. Our intent that this committee take that up this session, attempting to make it a little easier for people to understand and know what impact is what's actually going on with their taxes. So that's what we'll be doing. Now, if the public, anyone in the public knows that they'd like to testify in front of the committee, we do have a sign-up sheet, and we'd appreciate it if you put your name down. And where is it?
It's in the back.
Yeah, it's in the back, on the back table back there. So if you're going to want to testify, we'd appreciate it if you'd sign up on that. And with that, I think we'll go to the members and ask you to introduce yourselves, where you're from, and we'll start down in this end.
I'm Katie Sieben from District 57A, which is Cottage Grove, South St. Paul, Newport and St. Paul Park. Thanks for having us here, Ray.
Good evening. I'm Dean Simpson. I represent District 10B, and that's half of Otter Tail County, part of Becker County, and all of Wadena County.
Thank you, Representative. And I'm Ray Vanderveer from Forest Lake, and I represent Columbus, Linwood, Forest Lake, part of Hugo, part of Lionel, Centerville, and Scandia Township. And Hugo.
And I'm Maury Lanning. I think I came the farthest from Moorhead, Clay County, represent the city of Moorhead and northern Clay County, District 9A.
I'm John Lesh. I represent District 66A, that's St. Paul, Como Park, the north end, and the east side of St. Paul. Thanks for having us.
Thank you all, members, for coming, especially the ones that came a long way to hear this. And we have one more addition, the chair of the full tax committee. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Phil Krinke, represent cities of Shoreview, North Oaks, Lexington, Circle Pines, and Lionel Lakes. Glad to be here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All right, we'll start now with the Department of Revenue. If you'd come forward and give your presentation. And if you don't have it, there is a handout in the back that you can pick up. That's what they're going to be working off of, an outline. We have technical difficulties.
Can you hear me back in the room? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and residents of the Forest Lake area, thank you for coming tonight. And it's really an honor and a privilege to be able to talk to you a little bit about the assessment practices. And I know it's a very difficult subject matter, fairly complicated, but we hope that we can provide you with some testing. Let's go with that. I'll just speak. That we can provide you with a brief overview that tries to lay out some of the primary areas, the primary methods and practices that assessors use to come up with valuation estimates for the property. As the chairman has indicated, one of the things that we're really here for is to get some input from the citizens of the community and I know it's been very valuable to the committee, but it's also going to be valuable for us as a department to get your perspective on the assessment issues that you see regarding you and your neighbors. Having said that, what I'm going to do is present with the begin the presentation with a very brief overview. I'm not an assessor. I'm not very familiar with all the specific things that they do. I usually use that as an excuse. But I will turn over to John Hagan, who is in our property tax division. He heads up our education information unit, and he will walk through for you some of the major highlights of the property taxes that I use. One of the things I want to point out for you first, though, is that the Department of Revenue does not value individual properties. Rather, we oversee the assessment practices that are done by a combination of local and county assessors, and our primary concern is to make sure that we have some fair and independent assessments between jurisdictions throughout the state. And that's why we structured this presentation with the opportunity to have assessors on a panel, and they'll be here for making addressing specific questions depending on the issues that you will be raising if you come forward to the committee to have some testimony. Here with us today is Tom May, who is the Franklin County Assessor, Bruce Menke from Washington County, and Stephen Baker is the County Assessor from Ramsey. They will be available to address or answer any specific questions that you would have. One of the things about the assessment of property is that it's a combination of both art and science. And that is an extremely important factor to keep in mind. Not like the income tax or sales tax, where there are some specific types of procedures that can go through a fairly precise measure of the value for which the factor would be applied. And we determine the value of property. For a large part, there's a combination of using some sophisticated statistical techniques, but there is also an element of judgment involved. And must keep in mind that the assessor
is trying to come up with not a precise measure of value, but some kind of reasonable measure of value for your home and properties in your jurisdiction. The goal of an assessor, and I think the expectations of the property owner, are one and the same, and that is to come up with a fair and uniform valuation of property. What do we mean by a fair assessment? It is simply a reasonable selling price for your house. What do we mean by a uniform assessment? That the property values of your neighbors are also fair. In effect, what we're trying to do is trying to estimate what your house will sell for and what your neighbor's house will sell for. Real estate markets, or being an assessor, the assessor is faced with many challenges. Real estate markets in today's age is a function of international markets, international buyers and sellers. It is a function of national buyers and sellers. It is regional, local, and I often refer to as very local. What I mean by very local is that the assessor has to be not only cognizant of the statewide regional pressures or supply and demand factors in the community, but also be aware of the unique factors that are occurring within the community, between the streets, between the neighborhoods, off-lake, on-lake, those kinds of things. The factors that can influence the assessment range from some fairly straightforward factors that we're all familiar with to some that are not so necessarily readily evident. For example, the assessor is aware of the interest rate, some tangible market factors that can affect the demand for property. They also are cognizant of and try to measure structural factors such as square footage, lakeshore footage. They also have to be aware of potential emotional factors, such as, boy, it's a great view, or so-and-so bought a house so they wanted to be close to Aunt Mabel, something like that. These are all kinds of emotional things that enter into the market, which are very difficult to quantify, but can affect the selling price of any one property. Other factors, of course, and I'm on page 3 now, if you wanted to follow along somewhat with the handout. I have just listed some very general ones that the assessor really has to be cognizant of in a very general way. Of course, location, location, location is very, very important. The supply and demand for the property in any one particular location. The market activity, and this is a very important one, the fewer the sales, the more difficult it is for the assessor to gauge the validity of the market, coming up with some accurate measure of valuations for those properties. Conversely, the more sales you have, the more opportunities you have to gauge and measure that market. Land characteristics, the land tillable, is it being used for farm, wooded, pasture. More and more of our lands today are being used for recreational purposes, and there's a significant demand putting upward pressures on those prices as well. Is the land high or low with respect to swampland or something like that? Is it near a lake or a pond? All having significant influential factors on the price of the land. The mix of the property, the zoning elements within the community. The economic growth, is the area in a transition from going from agricultural to urban development. All these things put different pressures on the properties. So this is sort of just a background for you to keep in mind as we go through some of the more specific things that assessors do. So with that, John, I want to turn it over to you, and you can maybe walk through for them some of the more specific tools that the assessors use.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Hagen, and I'm very grateful, Craig, for the microphone. I'm losing my voice, so this will make my presentation slightly more meaningful to you. I'm going to give you a brief overview of the assessor's duties as they relate to the property tax process. At the outset, I'd like to use a football analogy, which always is very, very popular. There's a saying in football that says a quarterback gets too much credit for a game when the team wins and too much blame when they lose. And I think you could liken that to property taxes and say that an assessor gets too much blame when property taxes go up and too much credit probably when they go down. Before I went to work for the Department of Revenue, I was a county assessor. And on rare occasions, people would come up to me and say, well, you're doing a great job, thank you, my taxes went down this year. I never really had the heart to tell them I had little or anything to do with it, but I spent hours explaining to them why I didn't have that much to do with their taxes going up. Also on page 3, I'm picking up with all property is valued and classified with reference to its value and use on the January 2nd assessment date. Assessment date is an extremely important date, and basically everything that is on January 2nd is. If a structure exists on January 2nd and is destroyed by fire or for whatever reason, any time after that, it remains as part of the assessment. So January 2nd is a date that predicates the value of all property within the state. In Minnesota, there's 3 expectations of assessors to annually value property. Number one, the assessor is supposed to value a minimum of 1/5 of all properties each year, to the end that over a 5-year period, all the property within that jurisdiction or within that county will have been totally reassessed. So assessors should view and appraise all property at maximum increments of once every 5 years. A second requirement is that the assessor each year search the entire jurisdiction for any new construction. Any new construction that adds $1,000 or more in value, or any demolition of structures that reduces the value in any way, should be noted and added to the assessment rolls or removed from the assessment rolls. And finally, each year the assessor is required to make a diligent search of all properties throughout the county or the jurisdiction to make certain no properties were omitted from the assessment. And if they were omitted, they have to place them on the tax rolls. All this is done to the end that the jurisdiction will be properly identified and all property will be properly assessed. The job of the assessor is to establish something called market value. There are 2 definitions on page 3. The first one is a legislative definition taken out of a statutory definition, which is a little complicated, a little hard to get your arms around, largely because it has to encompass all the different types of sales activities that might take place, like an auction, to make certain that is within the definition of a market value. The second definition, which is just in back of the statutory site, which is prefaced, in other words, is a lot easier to understand. Market value is basically what a willing buyer would pay a willing seller in terms of cash for a property, with the buyer and seller each acting prudently, knowledgeably in their best interests, acting free of any undue duress. Essentially, the job of the assessor is to determine what a property owner would pay for a property, to try to replicate the actions of a property owner. On page 4, if you're following along. The assessor establishes a separate estimated market value for both land and the buildings, to the end that the total market value should reflect the value of the property, as should the land, the value of the land, and the value of the structure should independently also reflect the value of the property. Once the estimated market value is calculated, it has to be reflective of the highest and best use of the property. And this is kind of a difficult concept to get your arms around, too. Highest and best use is the most profitable and the most appropriate use within the market. I would venture that 99% of the time, all property is used at its highest and best use. If it is or not, though, the assessor is still required to value it at its highest and best use. Once the assessor has determined the appropriate estimated market value for a property, they have to classify the property. Now, I mentioned the assessor values property based on highest and best use. The classification of property is based upon the actual use. So whatever way the property owner is using the property, be it residential, agricultural, commercial, whatever the use is, dictates the classification of the property. Page 4, on mass appraisal portion, assessors use a mass appraisal process in valuing, which is a different scale from the individual appraisal process used by an independent fee appraiser during a mortgage or a mortgage for a mortgage company, for example. The mass appraisal process involves gathering field characteristics and data for land and buildings. It requires the assessor to maintain current information about the properties being assessed in local real estate market. This includes information concerning the land, such as location, as Mr. Fulton mentioned, size, shape, topography, soil conditions, the view, amazingly enough, adjacent property influences, lakeshore or commercial, and information concerning the style, size, the structure, the quality of construction, age, condition, number of bathrooms, fireplaces, porches, decks, garages, outbuildings, essentially anything that adds value to a property. The mass appraisal system involves the comparison and valuation of all residential properties each year based upon the actual residential sales from within that jurisdiction. In recent years, most jurisdictions have gone to a computerized mass appraisal system, which characterizes all the data and makes it much easier to make applications across the board and to try to determine valuation components that add to or detract from the value. Every time a property sells, a document listing the sale price called a certificate of real estate value is filed, and the assessor gets a copy of that document. All sales information is closely analyzed by the assessor. It's very important because the real estate sales information is a database for the statistical comparison necessary for the annual property assessment. Sales information can be augmented outside of the actual CRV by conversations with appraisers, real estate agents, multiple listing services, and any other service or any other source of data that might be available to the assessor to help them ascertain what the property's market value is. How well the assessor's value compares to what the selling for is determined through a sales analysis, which measures the assessor performance through something called a ratio study on page 5, if you're following along. The term refers to the process of comparing the assessor's estimated market value to the sales price. Ratio studies are used by the county assessor to determine the quality of the work of local assessors and how well they're meeting the goals they've established within that jurisdiction. Ratio studies are also used by the Department of Revenue during the State Board of Equalization to ensure that assessments in Minnesota meet the required levels of assessment, which for Minnesota's purposes are somewhere between 90 to 105%. The sales ratio for property is determined by dividing the assessor's estimated market value based on the January 2nd assessment date by the adjusted sale price, and sale price adjusted for time and terms of the transaction, and the result is a ratio. On page 5, there's a real simple example of a ratio where a market value is $185,000, the sale price is $200,000, and the resulting ratio of that calculation would be 92.5%. All the sales that occurred within a ratio study period, which takes place from October of 1 year through September of the year preceding the assessment, are separated by class for the jurisdiction. For example, all the sales in a residential grouping are grouped together. All commercial sales are grouped together for that jurisdiction. Next, you take the sales of that property type, array them from the lowest to the highest ratio. So you'd have the lowest ratio to the very highest. And after they're arrayed, the job of the assessor and the department is to pick the centermost ratio, which reflects a median ratio for that jurisdiction. And it's determined that that ratio is reflective of the typical valuation level of the assessment. If the sales ratios fall within the acceptable range of 90 to 105%, the assessment for that class is deemed to be acceptable. It must be remembered, and we add a caveat, that the valuations are based on sales which occurred in a prescribed time period. For example, for the 2005 assessment, taxes payable in 2006, for taxes payable in 2006, the sales which occurred from October 1, 2003 through September 30, 2004 are the sales study period that is determining, that the assessor uses to determine what valuation changes they'll make for the assessment date. This possibly contributes to the perception that oftentimes assessors' values are not reflective of market value, or they lag behind the market, the fact that they have this long lag time. When we were in Fairmont last week during the first subcommittee hearing, a gentleman addressed the legislators and said that expecting an assessor to estimate the value of a property based on sales that occurred somewhere between 3 and 15 months ago is a lot like hunting ducks. He talked about, he analogized, when you hunt ducks and the ducks are flying across, you lead the ducks and you fire a shot, and with a little luck you hit the duck. He was saying the what was wrong with this analogy is the assessors actually were aiming behind the duck when the duck was flying away and shooting, and at the same time they were expected to shoot the duck, which was an interesting analogy. At least Gordon and I thought it was an interesting analogy.
You had to be there.
I think you did. I might drop the duck story next time.
He thought it was interesting.
He did a much better job. If you're ever in Fairmont, try to look him up. Bottom of page 5, the goal, of course, would be to have all ratios at 100%. This would mean that every house that sells, the adjusted sales price would equal the assessor's estimated market value. Although this is an unrealistic expectation, a more realistic goal is to have a fair and uniform assessment. A fair and uniform assessment is one which has a median sales ratio that falls within the range of 90 to 105%. And a uniform assessment is one that has little variation around the median sales ratio. The less variation, the closer it is to that median, the better the quality of the assessment. When a sales ratio falls markedly away from the measure of central tendency, or the median ratio, it's referred to as an outlier ratio. Mr. Fulton testified to the property tax subcommittee last year and presented some ratio information. There was a lot of discussion over some of the outliers in that presentation and why some properties were so far outside of the median ratio or the measure of central tendency. As a result of that, we've urged assessors to pay a lot of attention to the outliers and make certain if the outliers should not be there. The outliers basically that are less than 65% ratio or more than 115%. They should analyze those ratios and see if there's some explanation of what happened and some reason where they probably shouldn't have been included in the study. For example, was there an improvement to the property that was not identified? Was there a structure that was added on without a permit that the assessor was unaware of? Was the transaction unusual and not representative of a typical market sale, which would cause it to fall outside of the definition of a market value transaction? Was the data on the property incorrect? As a result, the assessment was wrong and is a correction needed? On page 6 of your handout, there's a graph that shows how we evaluate the quality of the assessment. And the graph on that page reflects all these sales, residential sales in the state of Minnesota over the 2004 study period. As you can see, it's a pretty weighted towards the center. In fact, 75% of all the sales ratios are between 80 and 105%, which is a reasonably tight grouping. And again, this represents all the sales for the state throughout the state of Minnesota on residential property for the 2004 study period. Only about 6% of the ratios could be characterized as being extremely high or extremely low. At the end, on page 7, at the end of the assessment cycle, the State Board of Equalization meets and evaluates the quality of the assessment for each jurisdiction within the state. Every city, every town, every county. If the median ratio for a class of property falls outside of the range of acceptability, which is the 90 to 105%, the State Board of Equalization either increases the property to bring it within that range, which would be an across-the-board increase on that entire class of property, or decreases it to bring it within the range. In any event, after the State Board of Equalization, all properties throughout the state are equalized within that band of 90 to 105%. In the interest of time, I'm going to skim really fast over the appeals portion of the handout. It's there for a reference, and you have basically that same appeals information on the back of your valuation notice that you anticipate the arrival of every year at about this time. First of all, for the appeals, we recommend all property owners talk to the assessor first. It's so much easier as a rule to try to resolve issues if you go meet with the assessor and deal with them face to face. It gets a lot harder. The further on the process you get, the bigger the meeting, the harder it is to identify your problems and try to resolve them. If you don't have any satisfaction after meeting with the assessor, there are a more formalized listing of or opportunities for appeal. The first one is something called a local board of equalization, which is made up usually of cities or town officials, and the property owner can appeal their value there. A lot of metro jurisdictions have opted for something called an open book meeting, which has taken the place of local boards, and that probably is the way of the future, where more and more local boards, I think, are disappearing across the state and giving way to something called the open book meeting. The property owner has an opportunity to appeal there. If they're still not satisfied, they can go to the county board of equalization. You cannot, however, go to the county board of equalization unless you first appeal to the open book meeting, if that has taken the place of the local board or to the local board. You can't just decide to bypass the local officials and go directly to the county board. If you are unsatisfied at the end of that appeal process, you can go to the one of two branches of the Minnesota Tax Court. There's a small claims division, which encompasses all homesteads, most properties valued at less than $300,000, single-family dwellings, all agricultural homesteads, or any property where they're appealing the current year's homestead classification. Small claims division is very, very informal. It's basically like sitting around the kitchen table with a judge, and it's very informal. They don't follow court proceedings or court rules and formalities. It does not set precedent, and there's no written record of it that the property owner gets. If you choose to go to the regular division, you can't appeal the decision of the small claims court. If you go there, the county can't appeal, the property owner can't appeal. If you choose or you're not eligible to go to the small claims division, you can go to the regular division of property tax, regular division tax court. And it costs more. It's a much more formalized proceedings. Typically, people are represented by an attorney. The decisions of the court are written up, and they are appealable. So either the county or the individual can appeal their value if they are not happy with the determination of the court. Finally, I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about a series of mandated reports, assessment practices that can be found on page 8. Legislation initiated by the House Property Tax Subcommittee and enacted during the last session requires the Commissioner of Revenue to issue two reports on current assessment practices. Specifically, the legislation provides that the report shall include an analysis of existing practices and provide recommendations where necessary for achieving higher quality and uniform assessments and a consistency of property classifications. The first report, which is due February 1, 2006, which Mr. Fultman has just reminded me this morning how soon that is. the first one is due February 1, 2006, and the department has established a group of technical working people composed primarily of county assessors to address the specific issues. The first issue deals with the agricultural land values, including the green acres classification, if it's being properly implemented and if agricultural values are being uniformly applied from one jurisdiction to the next throughout the state. A second report will deal with the rural woodlands, basically wooded lands and inconsistent classification issues that have evolved from some of the rural woodlands. In some counties, they seem to be assessed as timber. Some have a tendency to classify those same properties as seasonal, recreational, or even residential on homestead. And we're trying to get consistent application and make any recommendations that may be needed to try to make certain all assessors are valuing all like lands similarly. A third report will deal with the valuation of resorts. There was some discussion during committee hearings about how resorts were valued. Oftentimes, there's been a real concern among legislators brought by the resort orders of how resorts are disappearing from the landscape because it's more profitable to turn them into condominiums or basically resell it. They can make a lot more money condominiumizing them or setting them up in some form of that variation of that and selling the same lakeshore over and over and over for each of the cabins. So because of the profit incentive, a lot of resorts are disappearing. During the course of those hearings, there was some discussion about how some assessors thought that the proper way to value a resort was as a resort, and others argued that it should be valued properly at the highest and best use that I talked about earlier. So we're going to make certain everybody's on the same page on that, and if need be, we'll come up with some recommendations on how to make the assessment of resorts more consistent. And a second report will be due February 1, 2007, and that includes four different issues. Number one is a study of 4D low-income rental housing, which is a follow-up of the 4D classes being reinstated for subsidized housing and the valuation and tax ramifications of that. A second study would be how to value lands enrolled in various federal or state conservation programs like CRP, WIM, CREP, if the assessor should value them and if they should be valued at a fee simple or some lesser valuation. A third report will deal with residential use properties, including seasonal recreational properties and residential homesteads and non-homestead properties. And that deals primarily with the issue that's become apparent over the last few years, where in some jurisdiction there seems to be a morphing of properties where they all appear to be similarly used on the outside, and they're typically cabins that are on a lake or a river. And in the past, these properties would almost without exception be classed seasonal, recreational, residential. There has been a concern that some of these properties are going to a residential non-homestead class or some other class which might have a better tax rate or more favorable tax treatment, and we want to make certain that all the assessment and all the assessment officials are classifying those properties correctly and similarly. And the fourth report will deal with the commercial industrial property and the valuation of commercial and industrial properties, which has become a much bigger issue throughout the state of Minnesota in the last few years with the advent of the state general tax, which requires commercial industrial properties to pay a tax. So it now matters if a business in Hallock, Minnesota, or one in Forest Lake are being classed and valued on a similar level. It makes a big difference. Finally, legislation passed last year, also initiated by the House Property Tax Subcommittee, requires the Commissioner of Revenue to develop a code of conduct and ethics for assessors. The code must be completed and recommended to the State Board of Assessors for adoption by January 1, 2006. And once the code is adopted, there will be a requirement that every assessor within the state, every licensed assessor within the state, will have to listen to an eight-hour seminar on ethics and dealing with the code of conduct. And I'm very, very happy to report that as we speak, that code of conduct is in the hands of the State Board of Assessors for a meeting today and tomorrow in St. Peter, and hopefully that will be adopted. So we're well ahead of schedule on that particular requirement.
Before we turn it over for public testimony, the one last thing that I want to cover starts on page 9. We thought it would be useful to just go over briefly with you this relationship that exists between the valuation of the property and the property tax that you pay. Oftentimes, the property owners are wrongly identify tax increases to valuation changes when in fact they were probably due to local government taxing decisions. On the other hand, the valuation of your property does have an effect on how those taxes are distributed. If you go page 9, what I'm basically going to do, we have a fairly complicated system, as Chairman Vanderveer indicated. What we're trying to do here for the purpose tonight is just simply zero in on two components. The valuation of your property and the local taxing decision as to how much money needs to be raised in that jurisdiction, and sort of give you some idea of how those two decisions interact and affect your tax. On page 9, the basic point is that the assessor's process to coming up with your valuation is a separate process from that of when the local governments are coming up with their local taxing decision. The local taxing decision, or the assessor's, as John indicated to you, the assessor's process is estimating your valuation almost primarily a year and a half advance of when the local taxing decision is actually made. And on page 9, we basically summarize for you those two processes. The assessor is determining your valuation as of January 2nd for each year. So, for example, for 2006, the taxes that are coming up next year, we're looking at values that were basically put in place and are estimated as of January 2005. Local governments are in the process right now of determining their final levies. The truth and taxation hearings are occurring for a final citizen input on those levies, and they will be put in place by the end of the year. And so that is a sort of a separate decision process in place. However, as item number two on page 9 indicates, the valuation of your property does matter with respect to how those taxes are ultimately distributed. If you go to page 10, we put together several examples of how to illustrate the relationship between the valuation of your property and the taxing decision that occurs at the local government level. What we have here are several examples, And we have a very simple hypothetical community comprised of three properties. You can see there on the on year one, the purple shaded coloring over year one, you see that there are three properties, each worth $200,000. As indicated, the local taxing decision by the local jurisdictions is a separate process from the valuation process. If you look at the upper left-hand corner of this chart, you'll see in that upper left-hand corner a levy amount of $9,600. What we're doing here for this simple community is assuming that the local governments, the city, county, township, whatever, combined are raising $9,600 in this community of three properties. The total property of those three properties totals up to $600,000. So you see the $9,600 and the total property in that jurisdiction as being $600,000. What happens is that once you have some idea of the value of the properties in a jurisdiction, and then you know how much levy is to be raised, the county auditor will divide that levy into the value and come up with a tax rate. In this simplified example, the tax rate is 1.6%. That 1.6% then, in year one of this example, is then applied to each of the three properties. Properties 1, 2, and 3 each have to pay 1.6% of their value, and in this case, they're each paying $3,200. You add that across the three properties, you come up with the amount of money that the local jurisdictions need to raise to pay for their goods and services. If we now put this scenario in motion and go to the next year, we roll through a couple of examples to show you what happens when the levy and or the valuations change. In year two, looking at alternative one, the yellow shaded or highlighted part of the chart, in this example, there are no levy increases at the local level. If you go up to the top of the chart and look at year two, alternative one, we're going to apply the $9,600 again to this scenario. But in this case, all values, all three property values in that community go up by 10%. A lot of people, when they see their valuation notices, when they see that valuation increase, they assume right away that's going to translate into a tax increase. Well, that may not necessarily be the case. What happens here in this example, when the levies do not go up, the value goes up 10% for each of the property. The valuation now for the community goes up from $600,000 to $660,000. You take the $9,600 into that tax base, and the tax rate now is 1.45%. In year one, that tax rate was 1.6. It was a higher rate. So you apply that lower rate as a result of the increased valuations, and the tax on those jurisdictions, again, are $3,200. There is no increase in tax. That's because the levy increase at the local level taxing jurisdiction didn't increase. And in this case, in this scenario, all the valuations for the three properties also increased at the same rate. In year two, another example, in this case, the levy increases by 10%, and there is no increase in the property values of the three properties in this community. Looking at alternative two in year two, it's sort of the greenish shaded part of the chart, you now have the tax levy going up from $9,600 up to that part of the chart which shows a 10% levy increase going up to $10,560. So the local governments are now increasing their levies by 10%. In this example, though, that there are no valuation increases for either amongst any of the properties. As a result, the tax rate has gone up to 1.76% from year one, which was only 1.6. In this case, everyone's paying the same levy increase because, again, all properties' valuations had the same effective change. In this case, no increase. So they're all paying the same amount of increase that local governments were levying to pay for their goods and services. If you go to year two, alternative three, the blue shaded part of the chart, in this case, we have a 10% levy increase on all value, and all values go up 10%. Again, another uniform situation where all properties are increasing by 10%, the levy is increasing by 10%, and again, the tax rate here goes from 1.6% and stays at 1.6% because the levy increase was offset by the valuation increases amongst all the different property types. So in this particular example, they're all paying the same amount of tax again. The last example, the gray shaded part of the chart, is probably more illustrative of what happens in real life. We have some properties going up, other properties not going up, so the valuation increases are not uniform across the jurisdiction. In this particular example, we have the levies going up by 10% by the local taxing jurisdictions, and in this particular case, only property one has an increase of 10%. The other two properties did not have a valuation change. And now we see a difference in the effects of that, combined effects of the levy increasing and the valuation changing on some properties but not the other. In this particular case, property one has an increase of 17% and the other properties only had an increase of 6.5%. Yet they each experienced, in two of those properties had an increase but did not have a valuation change. So that's sort of what creates some of the confusion amongst the taxpayers of the interaction between the value changes and the levy changes. What's important with that last example is that from assessment practices point of view, the value increase on that one house going up by 10%, if that really reflected a true market phenomenon, that's good. That's the way it should work. If it was a result of some unfair or inaccurate assessment practices, then that becomes a point of concern. Because we're very concerned that the valuations, not only for any one particular home or particular property, is fair, reasonable, but the property values are estimated fairly for all properties in that jurisdiction because it affects the distribution of the tax. With that, Mr. Chairman, that ends our presentation.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. And we have, I think if there's one thing we get out of this, is Chairman Krenke is fond of telling me, if you lower the tax for one class, you're increasing the tax on all other classes of property. But we have a couple of members of the legislature have joined us, and invite them to introduce themselves. Start with Representative Nelson.
I'm Pete Nelson, Representative District 17B, which is almost all of Chisago County.
I'm Senator Michelle Bachman, and it's my privilege to represent the ground we're sitting on right now. So thank you all for coming out tonight. I know it's been very informative.
Thank you. With that, we also have a number of elected officials here that I'd like to acknowledge and thank for coming. Council Member Cheetah from the Forest Lake City Council is here. We have Terry Smith, the Forest Lake Mayor, is here. Council Member Petrick from Hugo City Council has joined us. Council Member Haas is here from Hugo City Council. Thank you. And County Commissioner Dennis Hagberg is here. Thank you all for coming. Are there any questions for members for the department?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman and members, Mr. Folkman and Mr. Hagen, a couple of comments. I would presume that our expectations are that with the information that has started to go out to the different county assessors and local assessors, that sales ratio, we're going to see, for lack of a better term, an improvement, or there'll be more of them in that percentage in the center. With the exception probably being mostly in areas that are rapidly rising selling prices. And I think, Mr. Hagen, that's where you were trying to do that duck analogy. They're shooting where the duck is now, and what happens is that by the time the sale occurs, that it's much, much higher than that. My second comment, Mr. Folkman, and we've had discussions with the advantage of the open book process, that we get more and more assessors to do that and to encourage taxpayers to use that system. And the best example we could use was former tax judge Krauss, who on that small claims appeals process most of the time, not all the time, but the vast majority of the time, found that when the taxpayer was there and sat down in that kitchen table type of format with the assessor and really found out what was going on, and they had an understanding, most of those disputes were resolved. Is those both two fair and accurate statements, gentlemen?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Okay. Representative Krinke.
Just question to Mr. Maybe Mr. Hines can answer this, or maybe we don't have this information. What's the from 2005 to 2006? What is the total? What's the statewide value increase versus what the statewide actual tax increase? Or maybe Ms. Baker, I don't know which one of you might have that information.
Mr. Hines and Ms. Baker, if you could come up here, please. And would you, because then we're going to ask you to give us some I have some questions that would we you'd be of assistance with also. And for those in the audience that haven't seen been to committee hearings, this is Ms. Baker and Mr. Hines. They are nonpartisan House research for the Tax Committee.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, I do not have the valuation information, or Mr. Representative Krinke. The growth in tax under the Truth in Taxation levies is $589 million, 10.2% for the proposed for Pay 06 over Pay 05. But I have not, just recently got the valuation information. I have not had time to tabulate that yet.
Thank you.
Okay. And if you could, since you're up at the table, could you give us a quick background on the other reforms that were passed by the House of Representatives that didn't end up in the final tax bill? Ms. Baker?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think I'll make a few comments on limited market value, and then Mr. Hines is going to make a couple comments on other issues. On the back table, all the people should have a copy of a short subject that Steve and I prepared. And the short subject on limited market value does a quick overview of what limited market value is and how it works. And maybe I should say limited market value is actually a limit on the amount that a property's market value can grow from one year to the next for purposes of property taxation. And properties that or classes of property that qualify are ag homestead, non-homestead, residential homestead, non-homestead, seasonal rec residential, and timberland. Now, LMV has been in effect for a long time. Back to 1973, we had it in effect for a while and then took it off. And now it's been in effect again for a number of years. But what the 2000 legislature actually did is they extended the phase out an additional 2 years. And if you look at the bottom of that page, you see a little table down there. And the years, you notice that there in column one, it shows 15% over the previous year's LMV, which shows up several. I'm talking about the 05 and the 06 assessment years, and the 25% of the difference showing up in column two. Those 2 years kind of got inserted in the center of it to extend limited market value by this additional 2 years. Just very quickly on how it works, there's an example on the back of the page which shows that four taxes payable in 2006, which is the year obviously everybody is the most concerned about right now, is it shows that if a home is valued at $100,000 for the 2004 assessment and the assessor says for the 2005 assessment that it went up to $130,000, What they do is they look at 15% increase over the previous year, which is 15,000, or 25% of that 30,000 difference is 7,500. And the LMV that would be used is 100,000 plus you take the higher, so you use the 15,000 or 115,000. So what that really shows is that even though the house is valued at 130,000, it would only be on the property tax. The property tax burden would only be on 115,000 for taxes payable in 06.
Thank you. Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, do you want me to run through the various restrictions on levies or just go to the latest reform?
The latest reform being
the House's proposal in 2005.
The taxpayer satisfaction survey?
Yes,
if we could. We could discuss that. That's a.
And I'll briefly run through that, and the author of the legislation is present. He may wish to make some comments or correct me. But the House, in the House tax bill this year, there was a proposal for either a fairly significant change in the truth in taxation process or a substitution of a new process, depending on how you wanted to look at it, called the Taxpayer Satisfaction Survey. And this was Representative Krenke's bill. And basically, the Taxpayer Satisfaction Survey would replace the existing truth in taxation hearings with a new vehicle for which local feedback could be made to local elected officials about their levy decisions. And this process would involve including with the truth in taxation notice a form for the taxpayer to fill out indicating their acceptance or non-acceptance of the levy that's being proposed by the elected officials, and this would apply to counties and cities over a certain size limit. If the survey results came back with a sufficient number of forms indicating that the taxpayers were dissatisfied with the proposed increase, there would then be it would trigger a process for a referendum levy to be held so that the entire electorate could make a decision about whether the levy increase proposed by the jurisdiction would be acceptable or not acceptable. And in the case of them of a decision not acceptable, the levy would revert to the levy in the previous year. This provision was carried in the House tax bill. It did not make it into the final version of the tax bill after conference committee.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Any questions from members? Comments? Thank you. We'll now go to the public testimony portion of the meeting, and we have a number of people who have signed up. If you would care to testify, you could let us know. And the first person on the list is Councilmember Huss, City of Hugo. If you could come up to the table, please, and state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, I have a handout of a copy of a truth in taxation notice.
You can bring it up. Pretty. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chuck Haas. I'm a resident of the City of Hugo, and I'm here today to talk about the truth in taxation notice I received as a business owner in Vadnais Heights, and the same truth in taxation notice the business owners in the City of Hugo received. All of us are in a TIF district, a tax increment financing district. And one of the interesting things I found out, and perhaps you can follow along with me, is that it says that in 2005, the taxes on our property from Ramsey County were zero. In 2006, they'll be zero. The county was zero. And this, and those are the two places where you could go to your truth in taxation notice meeting and have your views heard. And there are some other taxes down there. The state general tax of several thousand dollars. No meeting is required. The tax for the tax increment district of several thousand dollars. No meeting required. To make a long story short, all the places where I could go or any of our business owners in Hugo could go to talk about taxes, they're not being taxed. But the jurisdictions that are taxing them, there are no meetings required. And I think that's one of the reasons they threw tea in the harbor.
Ended up getting a lot worse than that, too.
And so I thought maybe somewhere along the line someone could review and redesign this notice so that those people who maybe do not know the system and how it works will be able to know that there is a place that they have a voice and know where that place is.
So I have a question now, Councilmember Haas. There are no, in the areas that there's no taxes, looking down at the, now the tax increment, who pays that? Looking at this one.
Those thousands of dollars.
3121 at the bottom in the fiscal disparities.
Yeah, I pay that as the property owner.
You do, and you pay, yet there's, so you are paying tax.
Yes.
Yet there's no place for you to go to squawk about it.
That's correct.
Or agree with it or whatever. Okay. Where does the, maybe Mr. Hines, where does that increment come from? Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman and members, the oddity, I think, in this situation is because the taxpayer's tax is primarily going to the tax increment financing district, there's no hearing per se for the district. It's the tax amount is determined by the levies that are set by the county, the city, the school district, et cetera, and the rate that is calculated for those taxes applies to the taxpayer, but it doesn't, the tax isn't paid to those jurisdictions, it's paid into this abstract entity kind of called the TIF district. So in fact, it's the same, the taxpayer's tax is the same as if they were not in a tax increment financing district, but if they weren't, it would show so much of it going to the county, to the city, to the school. In this case, it's all going to the TIF district. It perhaps could be some kind of a cleanup or an amendment to how the notice is stated with regard to that, because certainly the city, county, and school district taxes are influencing how much this tax is. It's just that it doesn't, it's not being paid for those jurisdictions.
Representative Nelson?
And just kind of reiterating what Mr. Hines said, that Mr. Hines, that but for that tax increment, that actually, that tax would show up under City of Vadnais Heights, and it does for the other people that aren't in the district, and likewise the fiscal disparities would show up under the county portion of the levy. I think what Mr. Hines says is we need to come up with a way so that taxpayers are aware of that, in fact, that's where those taxes are going, and that in the, and you're a business person, I presume you understand some about the TIF districts and how some of the taxes is captured away from other units of government and put into special funding. That statute dictates what that captured increment can be spent on.
Yes,
as opposed
I do.
To just general levy.
And in the city of Hugo, right. We have several tax.
Several TIF districts, yes.
And I look, our finance director and I went through the TNT notices of our businesses, and they look the same.
Thank
so
you.
I would agree with you that, you know, some housekeeping would be in order.
Thank
and
you.
That was my hope in coming.
Thank you. Well,
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Krenke.
Maybe for the edification of the people who are here, maybe we could have staff give them just a brief snippet of what a tax increment finance district is and what fiscal disparities is, so these people have some clue as to what we have to deal with in this convoluted process.
It's a way to get people in Forest Lake to pay taxes to other parts of the city, isn't it? I mean, Mr. Hines, you have Ms. Baker?
Just
As brief as possible, Steve.
Mr. Chairman, tax increment financing is a mechanism whereby a city designates an area within its boundaries that has to meet certain criteria, typically of some kind of blight condition or some need for rehabilitation, and basically forms this district whereby and then usually invest some money into that district and usually improving the infrastructure past taking out some existing buildings and borrows money to do this through bonds. And then the growth in value within the district as new property owners take over and presumably benefit from the additions to the improvements to the property and improve their own property, the increment of value that's added goes, rather than paying the general tax to the county, the city, and the school, goes into paying off the bonds which are used to improve the property. That's a very commonly used economic development tool across the country, very popular in Minnesota. And so in this case, as I said, the taxpayer's tax technically goes to the tax increment district, and it really does go there, but it is the amount of tax is the same as that taxpayer would be if they were not in the district, and that's why it's kind of confusing as to who's really determining what that level is. That even though this seems to suggest there's no one setting it, it's the same actors that influence the taxpayer. Just for disparities, too, Mr. Chairman. Fiscal disparities is a program where commercial industrial tax base is shared throughout the metro area. And so each jurisdiction, a portion of their commercial property is contributed to a tax-based pool that is then based on how much the value has grown since 1971. And then that tax base is redistributed out to the jurisdictions in the metro area based on factors mostly in reverse proportion to their wealth. So the poorer a community is in terms of tax base, the more they get from this. In order to make the money work out in that situation, a portion of the taxpayer's tax will go into this area-wide pool called fiscal disparities, and really is then dispersed to all the jurisdictions across the metro, not necessarily to the one where the taxpayer property is. And that only applies to commercial industrial properties, and it does make things confusing.
Thank you, Mr. Arians. So if we think that doesn't make sense, we're probably right. But anyway, we'll
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Haas, Councilmember Haas, that does sound like just a technical correction, though, possibly, that we could do to have that show up. But I do have one question. Somebody from going to a truth and taxation hearing if the locations are listed on the form?
No.
It's just that they don't know the relationship between. Thank you.
Thank you,
Councilman.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I forgot in my presentation to point out page 12. It might be appropriate to show that after this discussion. When people ask about how the property taxes are calculated, to some it's a fairly easy explanation. I just demonstrated, but for many of us others, it's a kind of a mind boggling situation.
Good to see we have this all under control. Rod Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
You have a handout. Thank you. And if you could state your name for the record and make sure you sign in or I get yelled at.
I am Rod Johnson. I'm a resident of Ramsey County, and I'm here representing my employer, the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation. We operate in the East Metro area. We're a nonprofit operating foundation, and one of the things we do is provide supportive housing. Affordable housing that has services linked to it for the elderly, for low-income families, and for single adults. And first of all, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I want to thank all of the people, that yourselves and others, who had the commitment last year to help us with the providing some relief on affordable properties with reinstating the 4D classification. The first handout I gave you just indicates the seven properties that we manage that are taxed, and the new classification assists four of those properties, which is an extremely important thing for them. You'll notice that there are three properties there that didn't meet the 75% rule, and I'll come back to that one in a minute. But the one I'd like to focus on, just to help describe the challenge here, and this has both to do with meeting the 75% of the units rule and the notion of what a property is, what its evaluation is the case of Redeemer Arms that I passed out to you. Redeemer Arms is a 150-unit facility at the corner of Dale and University around in 94, the freeway, Dale and the freeway in St. Paul. It was sponsored by a church, and it's an elderly disabled program, but most of the tenants who live there have mental illness. We took over this troubled property in 1999, and the information is on the sheet. I won't go into all of the details, but it's a very vulnerable population, and we manage the property and provide services so the tenants that live there can maintain residential stability, get employed so they can be part of our community and not end up being moving from place to place and having difficulties. So in 1999, when we got there, this facility needed extensive renovation. Over the next several years, we raised the money to do that and are going through that process. And if you look down at the bottom, how this relates to the property tax issue is the taxable market value jumped from $5.1 million to $8.7 million in 1 year after our $3.5 million rehab. So the issue here is that I think a couple of things could be done to help us with this kind of a situation. One would be to have some sort of a system that directs assessors to take into account on their evaluation approach to property the income produced by that property. This is a HUD property. Our rent increases the last 2 years have been 2.4% and 3.7%, both dictated by HUD. And so we cannot just increase our rents to pay for increased property taxes and other types of ongoing expenses that go up. So that would be one issue. This really, unless we're able to control our costs, this really jeopardizes our ability to maintain these properties as community assets, which we want to do both for the residents that live there and for the surrounding communities. And having a 46% increase in taxes after, and if there's a question about whether we're really increasing the value of the property a lot, I listed on the back of the sheet about Redeemer Arms is the type of things we did. This building was built in 1964 and needed its complete plumbing system redone. 15% of the units didn't even have running water when we took it over. So it was just getting this building back into shape to function as affordable housing. The other issue that I would urge you to reconsider is the method to qualify for the new 4D. The 75% rule is very limiting as to what type of restrictions are looked at. And the fact that this is a 202 project and doesn't have Section 8 for all of the units means that it does not qualify. One of our other properties that's listed on the first sheet I gave you missed by one unit of qualifying it for that cost reduction.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think the House version had these issues, did it? I don't think it had. Did it have the 75% rule, Ms. Baker?
No, it did not. Chairman, I think the 75% rule was in there, but I'm not sure that at that point in time it wasn't a threshold where the whole building would receive the benefits. So there was kind of a point at which you reached that. The way the law got passed now, the 75% isn't nearly as critical, because if you only had 80% that qualify, only 80% of the building receives the 4D. So you could lower that ratio if you wanted to whatever, as long as the percentage of units that qualify are the ones that you're going to, you know, actually get 4D.
Any questions from members? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Tracy Smith. Terry Smith, I'm sorry. Is the mayor here, or did he step out? Okay. Mr. Oakes. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening. I'm a financial officer of this particular building you're sitting in.
And could you state your name for the tape?
Tom Obst, OBST.
Thank you.
And the reason I'm here, I'm pleading for a change of classification for us nonprofit places such as the VFWs, the Legion, and so forth. Now, we are obviously, like the Wilder Foundation, we've got some of the same issues, although not all our members are mentally challenged. We do have some problems here. But the thing is, we raise our money through, as you know, gambling, the bar, and the restaurant. And we're having a problem with demographics. Most of our, a great many of our members are dying off. And it is very difficult to raise money from people who are not here. We have a situation right now. This building pays about $60,000 a year, and we give away about $180,000 a year. Now, we could give a lot more money away if we didn't have to pay taxes.
Me too.
Well, I've never heard of you giving anything away, right? But in any event, we're in a situation where we'd like to talk about reclassifying properties such as what we have here and putting us into a different category if it's possible. Now, I don't know what kind of agenda you guys have or could do with this, but we need some relief, and that's what we're here for.
Thank you, Mr. Oakes. This is, and you, the type of relief would be specific to Legions or?
VFWs, Legions, or nonprofits.
Or nonprofits in general.
I think that that's, you know, the more people you get in line, the better you're doing. But as particularly the VFWs and the Legions, I mean, this is a veterans group. Mm-hmm. And like I said earlier, we're losing a lot of veterans. Consequently, our base is shrinking.
It's from members. Okay. Representative Simpson.
What's the history, say, the last 5 years? What have you seen as far as the tax increase? Is your tax been stable, or are you seeing?
Well, we've had a couple of instances where we've had one of the parcels here has been jacked up over 115% in 1 year. That's the unimproved parking lot on the corner that some of you probably are parked on right now. But it's one of those things. I mean, the assessor has been treating us as we're classified basically as a, what do you call it?
Commercial?
Yeah, and we're not really a commercial establishment. So we don't know how to deal with this. And right now it's one of those things where I don't know what kind of relief we can get from the legislature, but it'd be nice to get something, even if it's not 100%.
Is anyone here from Washington County? Just wondering what percent of Washington County's property would be nonprofit. Do you have that offhand? you. Senator Bachman.
Mr. Chair, my question was related. I wondered if perhaps Nonpartisan House Research might have an estimate if the legislature were to make such a change that nonprofits would not be taxpaying entities, what the impact would be upon the state.
Off
state
the top
revenues.
Of your head, that's something.
You'll get back to us?
Mr. Hines.
There's a lot of, just using the term nonprofit, I think encompasses a pretty broad spectrum of entities that you really need to think about what kind of nonprofit. There's something we all call charitable institutions, mm-hmm. which those are exempt. Lots of people kind of make that assumption that if it's nonprofit, it's charitable. That's not the assumption that we make in architecture. But I think, you start getting into what kinds of entities you're talking about, and it might be a need to exist, but, and I don't know if people would really get data on it very easily, but we can sure see what we can do.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bachman.
I'm wondering if we're talking about an entity like Legions, like the Legions and the VFWs and that sort of thing, if we could limit it to that, do we have any idea what the revenue impact would be on the state if we exempted those organizations?
Mr. Hines.
We don't certainly don't know here. It seems to me that this kind of proposal has been made in the past. So I wonder if we
might
look
have
back
some.
To some, if we might be able to find that some data has been gathered. It sounds familiar, but I certainly have not been able to know.
Thank you. I'd be curious to know.
I've got a question. What constitutes a charitable institution? We are a charitable institution. We give away quite a bit of money every year. Is there a limit or how much you have to give away or not give away?
Mr. Chairman, what makes you taxable as opposed to the ordinary run-of-the-mill nonprofit organizations is the fact that you have the liquor sales and the revenues from liquor sales. There is a provision in the law that for nonprofit entities like Legions, if they didn't sell alcoholic beverages and they use their facility for profit making purposes for less than 5 days a year, I believe. There's a greatly reduced class rate and would be free of the state general tax. So that would create its own set of financial problems for you, I guess, if you quit selling alcohol. But it's basically the sale of alcohol that costs you the class rate.
If we just gave it away, we'd be all right.
it might help tonight, Tom. Okay. Any other questions? Comments? Well, Mr. Olds, thank you. We'll
thank you.
Get this information, look at it, and I'm sure we'll talk. I think the mayor is back. Mr. Smith? Welcome to the committee, Mayor. Thank you for coming. And if you could just state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, my name is Terry Smith, Mayor of Forest Lake. I actually just wanted to come before you the same item here. Veterans organizations and the Legion, they came before us on our Board of Equalization with some real issues with their property and how they were being taxed. Now, these are guys that have given to the country time and again, and they give to the communities. I mean, these people reinvest everything that they do here into the communities. They help police departments, kid organizations. They keep on giving. And this particular Legion, Broadway, especially in Forest Lake, property values are escalating. This is prime commercial property. They've been here a long time. But because it's prime commercial property, they're being taxed as if they have a prime commercial business, and as far as their property status goes. And it was actually a suggestion I made to them that I thought, we couldn't help them out. We couldn't lower the valuation. The county has it valued what it's worth. But this is, they're really a nonprofit. They're an organization that reinvests in their community. They do this all over the state. And I personally was just going to ask that you guys give serious consideration, at least to the veteran organizations in the state of Minnesota, as far as a new classification on the tax code. And that was all I had to say. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. There may be some questions. So, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Folkman, Mr. Hagan. In a case like this, is it correct or incorrect that the subject property could apply to the different taxing jurisdictions for tax abatement? Is that a correct or incorrect statement?
Mr. Faulkner?
Ms.
Baker. Nelson, I see enough county types out there in the audience that somebody probably knows that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess my point was that short of changing the classification statewide, which earlier testimony stated how broad it is when it comes under nonprofit status. That
yeah, but case we're just talking veteran organizations here, not broad nonprofit. I'm just speaking veteran organizations.
Mr. Chairman, what I was saying is that then individual entities could handle it on their own case-by-case basis. They would be the ones that would be impacted in a declining amount of revenue. It could be handled, in my mind, like many abatements are, that the entity would go to the city, they would go to the county, and the options would be there. But it certainly, Mr. Mayor's one of the many avenues that we would look at. I wanted to just put it out there as a possibility, having the same end result coming about. So,
no, thank you.
Any other questions for the mayor? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Mark Rudholm. Did I pronounce that right? Rudholm?
Prudhoe.
Prudhoe? Prudhoe. I'm sorry. Welcome to the committee.
Yeah, I'm Mark Prudhoe. I live in Forest Lake, and I'm just a regular guy. But
why we're here.
I'm even more confused now about property taxes.
Well,
you know, just simply
you
because...
You get elected to the legislature.
I moved here 11 years ago, and the county assessor was out to our place 2 weeks ago, first time in 11 years. And I know a person that lives on the lake. They've lived there 23 years, and the assessor's never been to their house. But my taxes, and I feel like a weenie because my taxes have only gone up 19%. Versus what some of these other people have said. But I still don't understand. I've tried to sell my house for 2 years, and I can't sell it. And it's being assessed at $350 this year, and I couldn't get $349.9 for it last year. So maybe I shouldn't be up here. But I just don't understand how my taxes can go up 19%, but I can't sell my home for what it's being assessed for. And I had it on the market for 2 years.
That does seem a little odd. You know, when we look at this report, and I was going to ask this sales ratio report, I think it's interesting to see that, members, if you look at that graph, that 43% of the values are between 90 and 105%, and I think what that means is 57% of the time they're wrong. And wrong is a pretty small target because right is being within 15% of the value. So I think maybe we need to work on that. But did you, just a question, did you go through any of the appeals processes?
No, I haven't.
You haven't? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's what I was going to suggest. Board of Equalization is the place where you need to go, and you get a notice of that meeting, which is typically in the spring of the year, April or May. And having chaired a Board of Equalization myself for 22 years, we hear lots of stories like the one you're outlining, and that's the board that has the power to make adjustments if your property is unfairly valued. And what they need to do is to take a look at comparable property and how that is assessed, look at the sales in your neighborhood or area and what those sales have been going for as opposed to the market value that the assessor has. And so if you haven't gone through that process, I would strongly encourage you to do that. That's you're right, under the law.
Yeah, I think one of the problems is the only comp that the assessor came up with. I live on Forest Hills Golf Club. I live on the 5th fairway. There's a house sold on the 8th fairway, probably right at the peak of the market, you know, for $368. And I believe, at least that's what the assessor impressed me with, was they used that comp to assess my property. You know, so I didn't understand that either.
No.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I might follow on, that's the issue you need to bring to the Board of Equalization. The other thing I want to comment on, that under Minnesota law, the assessor is required to view property every 4 years. And if your property, in fact, has not been viewed for 11 years, mm-hmm. that's not according to law. But I know that there are times assessors go around and view a property without the resident, the property owner, knowing about it. I don't know if that's happened in your case or not.
Well, she was in the house 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
Yeah, and assessed it.
But they're supposed to go in every 4 years.
Yeah.
I believe it's 5, Representative.
Five. Okay, 5. Yeah.
Didn't we just change it
yeah.
about a year ago or so?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that would be mm-hmm. one suggestion.
Okay. All right.
But
one more question. How do I get to the local? Can't remember what you call it. I have to go through this process. There's a local board I have to meet with first?
Yes, and I think you might have missed that.
Okay.
These guys are good at that.
Okay.
They know the rules.
Thank you.
And there's a lot of rules. Thank you for coming. I appreciate the testimony. Okay, is there anyone else in the audience who care to testify? Oh, I'm sorry, we do. Councilmember Cheetah. And I did just notice the two other people that signed up, so we will get to you.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Dick Cheetah. I'm from Forest Lake. I'd like to commend Mr. Hines on his graph on page 10, because the simplification of this is great.
It's a beautiful
combination.
We do want to give credit for the commendation to Mr. Faulkner, because being with the assessing part, he gets the most attack. So now you did a good thing, yeah. Mr. Faulkner.
Wait for the punchline.
I think that the generally, after being at the school district and our city truth and taxation, in reality, year two, your alternative four, is just barely touching what really happens. Values are all over the board. The tax itself is not broken down. It's in a grouped form, but the actual truth in taxation and the documents that are provided to the taxpayer Break it down into the county, the city, the state, the special taxing districts. And the problem that I see is that when the taxpayer looks at this, he doesn't know which one of the entities is impacting him. He sees that there's an increase in market value. He sees that the bottom right-hand corner indicates the percentage change. And he also sees above that the change from 2005 to 2006 in taxes in dollars. But when he goes to a truth in taxation, the question is, did the 5.7% that Washington County increased their budget impact, and how did it impact on the local level your tax picture? Because the combination of an increase in value plus all the fluctuations by every one of the entities really masks what the taxpayer wants to know. Wants to know when he goes to a truth in taxation, is the budget going to impact my taxes? If so, at what percentage is it going to impact? And those are the questions that just don't seem to get answered. I know that most entities look at forming budgets that try to only minimize the impact on the taxpayer and maximize the ability to collect dollars based on increase in value of your community. And I think everyone understands that, because if you went backwards, you'd find that per capita, a certain number of dollars is necessary to maintain services within a community. And if you are finding those services acceptable, then moving forward with the same acceptability is all right. So my concern is that a clarification in the documents that come out that would be clear enough to indicate the impact of all of the entities that are placing dollars against your real estate, the impact that it makes on the final product. There is no percentage, it's a dollar adjustment. I looked at it knowing that the county, or knowing the city, for example, of Forest Lake had a negative impact of 1.9%, but the final product due, in my particular case, due to an increase in assessed value of 15%, zeroed it. I had a zero impact from the city of Forest Lake. But on the county's side, which I had their budget, which was 5.7% increase, I was increased at 10%, but the bottom line is they benefited me because my assessed value went up 15%. So I collected, or I benefited from that. School district had two of them, one at 35%, and one at 13%. When it was all factored in, my total tax went up 15%. But I think most people are not arguing the point that necessarily taxes are out of line or values are out of line. They want to know exactly how you're applying the numbers, so that when they look at this, they don't have to go to every one of these truth in taxations. They can pick the one that's hitting them and not all the rest of them.
Okay. I guess I have a question. So you think that the form could easily be made? What would your suggestion be?
Well, I think that at the way the form is right now, Mr. Chairman, is the impact of 05 to 06 on any one of the entities is not spelled out. The impact of the entity on the total adjustment is not spelled out. We're working with gross numbers. I think it could be simplified, and at that point, I think the taxpayer would be more satisfied with the results.
Thank you. Is this something that could be worked on a napkin at the Laker, or is this?
I hope so.
If it can, it's not worth doing. Ms. Baker, did you have a comment?
A lot of those numbers were taken out. So it's a question of how much is taxpayer overload for information, and how much do you want to give taxpayers, and how much don't you on a form? Because when legislators and people talked about the form, it just looked like it was too much information. And so one of the streamlining aspects was, let's cut it back. And that was one of the features of the cut back.
Representative Kroenke.
Mr. Chairman, I believe this year was the first year that we allowed counties to include, counties and cities to include budget information in the truth and taxation statement. Is that correct?
Ms. Baker.
Yes, Representative Kroenke, the law has been very, very clear up to this, prior to this change in 2005, that local governments couldn't put any information other than what was specified in law, and they couldn't put any additional flyers and or you know, information regarding budgets and levies and why things happened and state aid changes. And this year in the tax bill, there is a provision that there can be inserts put in, and I did some checking around, and I don't think that very many inserts were used this year, although one reason I think that so few were used is because since the legislature didn't end until in July, just timing-wise, everything, it just, I think in future years, inserts may become used more than they are this year. But yes, this year is... this year they could have used inserts, but there is added expense. There's more weight in mailing, and some of the truth and taxation statements don't lend themselves very well to putting an additional piece of paper in there, which I think is another reason why a lot of them didn't do it.
So I guess, Mr. Chairman, the response is that, again, legislative change this year does allow cities, counties, as well as school districts to put additional information with regard to changes in budget. You built a new fire hall. You had a large business, leave town and leave a property vacant. Therefore, levy assessment or levies on that property assessed value went down. Whatever it might be, again, the legislature is trying to give the opportunity for more information to the taxpayer, but at the same time, as Ms. Baker explains, we're trying to also keep it as simple as possible for those people who merely want to give me the high level summary of what's going on, and then allow the individual to either go to a hearing or to call their city hall, to go to the county assessor, whatever it might be, in order to facilitate a response to the question that they have specifically. So we're trying to accommodate cities and counties to include additional information which previously wasn't allowed.
Mr. Cheetah.
I think that the issue of accommodating the citizen with the appropriate documentation, and especially allowing the citizen to determine where the impact is. The current system, even though it's streamlined, doesn't allow that, and not only that, when the individual comes to a truth in taxation, entity that is operating the truth in taxation has no information on the other entities that are impacting the tax picture. And so he can only answer the questions that are related to city, or in our case was at ours, we only could deal with that. So the citizen is left really searching to determine who did impact me on my taxes, because I can't tell whether it's the county, I can't tell whether it's the school district. I can surmise by looking at a tax statement who is impacting, but I think rather than chase the citizen around looking for the information, to be the old system that showed the percentage increase, even though it might have been cumbersome and maybe put some people in overload, I think the average individual that looked at a large percentage behind any one of the entity could surmise that that's where the impact came from. Thank you.
So, Mr. Tito, you're saying instead of allowing the entity to report, you would require them to report.
Well, I think that the responsibility for the spending of taxpayers' money and collecting taxpayers' money, the information and the responsibility to inform the taxpayer is a burden that all of us have that are in elected office.
Thank you. Any other questions for Councilmember Tito? Senator Bachman.
Sure, not for Mr.
Cheetah. Sorry.
Other than Merry Christmas, I hope everything's going well. I'm wondering a question from House Research or Nonpartisan Research. If you had any idea how many local jurisdictions chose to put that figure on their truth in taxation, how many opted to let the public know the percentage change, either increase, decrease, or neutral? Do we have any way of knowing?
Ms. Baker.
Chairman, Senator Bachman, I think there's a little bit of confusion what we're talking about here, because the percentage change that is being referred to here for each of the local jurisdictions was a percentage change that pre-2001 was on the truth in taxation statement. Now we just have one overall bottom line. What Representative Cindy was talking about was inserts of just general information where a city can have an insert saying, you know, we built a fire hall, or we had, you know, these kind of things happen, and as a result of that, plus other miscellaneous, and they could itemize and say things that were happening, or population changes, or things that change in infrastructure, or whatever, they could put an insert in the truth in taxation statement, which was, you know, just a general kind of comment as to what was happening. And from what I could tell, and I don't know if the department knows, but the counties that I called, I don't think there were too many that actually chose to put those inserts in their truth and taxation statements this year. Partially because of the lateness, partially because of just, you know, by adding them it cost more money, and, you know, I think they had already pre-ordered the truth and taxation statements, of which was hard to put them in. So I think for lots of reasons, I don't think too many of them put them in this year. But that's just kind of anecdotal for me calling different counties and asking if they use them. So I sure don't have any kind of...
Well, I appreciate that, because I'm wondering if this is optional, Mr. Chair, and thank you for answering that question. If it's optional, I'm wondering what incentive counties would have to issue an insert. If it costs them money, if they don't have to do it, I'm wondering how many would do that. And I think Mr. Cheetah's point is then the taxpayers without knowledge as to what percentage increases there are.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bachman, I guess the reason would be to explain why the property tax increase is there. Mm-hmm. Because that way they can go through and give the various reasons for why they have to increase their budgets, and maybe it's because state aid cuts, maybe it's because of various other reasons, so they can say why those events happen. So that would be their
Well, I understand that. I guess what my point is, I hear what Mr. Cheetah is saying, and I'm wondering if the counties would have the inducement to do that to the public, and the public wouldn't have that information then when their tax bill comes. if it's an optional measure.
We have, thank you, Councilmember Cheat. I think you're safe to get up for the fourth. I did notice another elected official, Councilmember Carlson from Lionel Lakes, has joined us. Thank you very much. Rich Olsen. Rick Olsen. Welcome to the committee. If you can state your name for the tape.
I'm Rick Olsen, a Chautauqua County Commissioner from District 2. And I appreciate you holding these hearings. It's a nice opportunity for us to, because we hear a lot of the other side of the taxes. And I'd like to make a comment, and then I have a question for you. I'm concerned about our county local levy going up, and a lot of that is our decision as a local county board. We've decided to build some libraries. We've done some road bonding, and I have no problem accepting that. However, the legislature passed a gas tax, which, if that would have been signed into law, our county would have seen another $1 million in revenue. And we have 400 miles of county roads, and our engineer says we should be paving 20 miles a year for a 20-year life cycle. Well, to repave a road for us is $250,000 per mile. To do a reconstruction is $1 million a mile. So we're looking at trying to build funds so that we can do these, you know, approximately $5 million a year, so we can repave roads without having to bond. And things like that gas tax would really benefit us. A wheelage tax would also be beneficial. That would raise Chautauqua County approximately another $1 million a year. So there, I see them as really a user fee that goes to improve the roads that the people would be driving on that would be paying those taxes. One of the other concerns I have is that in our Health and Human Services meeting, we just voted on three resolutions to approve using local levy dollars to meet shortfalls from state. One of them was MFIB, a sliding scale daycare for parents coming off of MFIB. We're going to use local levy dollars to meet there were state dollars were short on that program. So I'm concerned that in efforts to balance the state budget, many dollars have been forced onto local property taxes, because we made a decision. I will grant that was our decision to do that, but we felt it was a valuable program. But it also, I believe, should be funded by the state. We shouldn't have to be using local levy dollars for that. That's my comment. My question is, I've sat through 13 truth and taxation hearings as an elected official, locally elected official. And one of the things I keep hearing is that especially senior citizens are concerned about the rapid increasing of property values and property taxes, and that they're going to be taxed out of their home. And I guess my question would be then, what if we as a state froze people's property taxes at age 70 with a means test that when they reach age 70, their property taxes stay the same? Their assessed values would continue to rise, but their tax would stay the same as they reach age 70. And, you know, statewide, I understand there would be quite a dramatic impact to that, but I don't want to be the one being accused of taxing somebody out of their home.
With regard to that, MFIT, so you're raising property taxes on some people to pay for babysitting other people's kids?
That is correct.
And you're doing that because?
Because the state is not stepping up to the plate with its... It's a state-funded program, and it was shortfall, I believe, approximately $30,000. I could probably get you the correct amount.
But that was your decision?
Correct.
Okay. Any questions from members?
Well, let me just...
Representative Krenke.
I think that we've had the discussion here, and... hopefully people have a better understanding of the situation, that whether it's a limited market value, whether it is a lower property taxes on housing for disabled or elderly people, whether it's not taxing American Legions, every time we change the property tax structure, we are going to shift then the cost of running the city and the county to another classification of property. So, again, folks, if you lower it here, you're going to raise it somewhere else, because whether it's the city of Forest Lake or it's Washington County or Chisago County, you just said your budget, in order to pave the roads, in order to provide mandated programs from the state, whether it's to provide police, fire services. So as those costs go up at the city and the county level, then who bears the burden, and how do we spread the burden across the different property tax classifications? So as I said, everybody said, well, I want an increased level of service, or I want the same level of service. Who's going to pay for it?
No, that's a very fair point, and that's who would pay for it, the balance of the taxpayers. Right. But I do not know, you know, because I don't know the percentage of 70-year-olds in the state that, if this were to become a law, would meet that criteria, and how it would have to be spread out over. But I do recognize that it would be a cost for the fellow taxpayers. Well,
we have had legislation that I was a co-author where it's the Minnesota Senior Federation's proposal that would cap property taxes at a level. Is that right? I can't remember. Yeah, cap it at what, 3-4%? I'm sorry. It was a proposal that would say it would cap anyone's property taxes at 4% of income. So that would be statewide. It would do that. So it would put a relationship between income and property taxes. Not totally put property taxes on the ability to pay, but it would certainly put a cap on the percentage of property taxes you would pay relative to your income. So we have had those types of proposals. We have had discussion. We've looked at them. But again, remember, when you do that, you put a dramatic shift in terms of which properties are going to pay more taxes and which properties pay less.
And members do have in your packets a number of House Research short subjects that discusses the deferral programs, and we do have a few we can put out in the back for senior citizens. Did you have another comment, Commissioner?
Well, no, I do appreciate that, and I guess what I'm looking at is, you know, not necessarily taking people's tax burden away, but just freezing it, or, you know, cap the increase. But I really see that for a senior citizen, because the reason I would look at age 70, I mean, so hopefully somebody's been retired 5 years, they're into their retirement, and you know, they're on that fixed income, and I guess it's kind of scary when, especially these people on lake property in our county, there's a lot of lakes and their value is going up 30% a year. It's not going to take a whole lot to force them out of that home. So I do understand what you're saying, Representative, about somebody's got to make up the difference, but I see it as a relatively small percentage. But because if they're still paying a base tax, you know, and the increase, you know, is a difference in that, so it's not like they're not totally paying their tax. Well, I appreciate being able to come before
Senator Bachman has. Oh.
Thank you, Commissioner, for enduring one more question. Yes. I did have a question for you, though. When you talked about means testing and the document that House Research had handed out, they talked about I don't know if they have a suggested cap. You had mentioned a cap, and I wondered if you had a suggestion that you spoke about at the county as a level that you'd be looking at for means testing.
Well, if you had 100,000 shares of 3M stock or something, you know, I mean, no, we have not, but I'm looking at, you know, somebody with enough wealth that they can maintain their retirement and, you know, still have spare dollars. That person, I don't know if it's, you know, $50,000 a year income as a senior, you know, I have not pursued it to that point.
And Mr. Chair, Commissioners, my follow-up question to that would be, are you looking at just income, or are you looking at divulging of entire assets? Because if you look at a percentage of the population, the wealthiest portion of the population is the senior citizen population. And so it would there's a big difference between income, which many seniors don't have a high income, but their asset portfolio is significantly larger than, let's say, a husband and wife that are 35 years old and have four children. And so you may have a higher income for the family level at age 35 with four children. They may be higher income earners, but their wealth, their assets, may be far diminished from the senior citizen who has an income that's maybe half of what those income earners would be. And so we would be looking at cost shifting the burden to maybe a young family with children who'd have to bear a higher property tax load, and the senior citizen who perhaps has greater assets that are available would have a reduced property tax level. So do you understand the concern that I'm...
Senator, I see a catch-22, actually, because that same person who is on that Lakeshore property going up 30% a year, they bought it in 1964, mm-hmm. and the property value has skyrocketed, so their asset, they're worth a fortune on paper, but they may only be living off of Social Security. But I do agree that it needs to be... I think assets would have to be into the picture, mm-hmm. certainly.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Any other questions for the Commissioner? Thank you, Commissioner Olsen.
Thank you
very much for coming. Mr. Hammerston. Nice to see you again. Sorry for the obstacle course. Oh, no. Why would you say that? How are you?
Just fine.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Marlo Hammerston. I live in Shoreview, Minnesota, and I'm also the chairman of the Property Tax Committee of the Minnesota Senior Federation. And one of the real reasons I wanted to speak tonight was to make sure that the people of the Forest Lake area know that we wouldn't need to have this meeting tonight if Ray Vandeveer's legislation 0992 would have passed in the last legislative session. Changing from, you know, this gobbledygook about market values and property values, and we're operating under the assumption that property is wealth. Property is not wealth. We have assessors in the back of the room who belong to the International Association of Assessing Officers, and they state that while once property was a measure of wealth, it no longer is a measure of wealth. It is income that is a measure of a person's wealth. Bill Gates isn't the wealthiest man in the world because of his property ownership. It's his income. And what House File 992 would have done, it would have changed the tax capacity from being based on the market value of a property to the income residing at that property, to the person's ability to pay. And if we had it set so that it would be a wash, a mathematical wash. There'd be the same income for counties and schools and cities. We're talking about homestead property only, not commercial industrial. It would have been a wash. It would have been more than a wash. You could have saved something like $450 million because we wouldn't need the property tax refund program. We wouldn't need the homestead credit program because the system would be fair based on a person's ability to pay. It didn't pass. There's another bill that Representative Vandeveer should get credit for, and that's one that's, I better give you the number, 2469 places, as Mr. Krinke said, a limit to what would be taken in the property tax. We have a limit for the income tax. You can't take more than 7.5% of a person's income for income tax, especially if you're a millionaire. You can't take more than 6.5% for the sale. There's limits, but there is no limit to the property tax. And that's why we're here tonight. That's why we have all of these stupid meetings time after time. Just as Ben Franklin said, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting new results. So you did this last year, you did it the year before last, and you're doing it this year, and the results are the same. People are going to walk out that door, they aren't going to be any more informed or happy about the property tax than they are now. So the question is, change the system, ladies and gentlemen. That's what we need to do. The first thing they heard about when they had the surplus that our Treasury is supposed to have, we had flashes on TV of each one of the politicians in the various parties. We need to have some kind of a relief for property taxes. Relief for property taxes. Relief does nothing. What we need is reform. The second bill that we just discussed that Representative Vandeveer has would provide protection by placing a limit. I'm glad the gentleman said something about people being driven out of their homes. And my Lord, I don't think, Senator, that Darlene Piddle, I don't know if you read the article about Darlene Piddle. Darlene was a member, was a resident of Minneapolis. She had a home that they raised the market value to about $170,000. She was a retired linen folder from the American Linen Company. Well, I don't think she had too big a portfolio. And she had a $850 property tax bill that she couldn't pay, and they took her home away from her. She couldn't stand it psychologically. She retreated to her bedroom. The city came, boarded up her home with her in it. She died in her home. That's the property tax system we have. That's what you people have to do something about. I'll do one more thing, and that's as long as this is talking about assessment, I'll give you an example of assessments. Unfortunately, I don't see that Mr. Baker is here anymore, my assessor. You want comparable properties? There's my property, and there's my neighbor's property, and there's an imaginary line between the two. Forget about the home he lives in. Forget about the home I live in. Just wipe that out and look at the market value of the dirt, the land on those two properties. The land on this side of the lot line is $4 a square foot. The value of the land on this side of the imaginary lot line is $18 a square foot. Same view, same place, same elevation, same dirt. Give me a reason why this is $4 a square foot and this is $18 a foot, especially when our Constitution says in Article 10, Section 1, that there should be uniformity in taxation. Now, if you think $4 versus $18 is uniformity, I don't know what the problem is. There is no uniformity. Talk about the sale ratios. There is no uniformity. We have a book system. That's what it is. That's what we're talking here tonight, about a book system. And you must fix it, and you must fix it fast, because the people of this state isn't going to stand for more of these ridiculous meetings which end up with nothing. But I appreciate you having them.
Well, Mr. Hammerstein, I like everything you said, but stupid meeting, that part. But thank you very much. Are there questions for Mr. Hammerstein? Okay. Seeing none. Anybody else in the audience would like to testify? Come on up, sir.
I'm Bill Olson, a member of VFW, also a member of 40 of the American Legion, and I'm just going to go back to a question that was asked a while back as to why we can't qualify for tax exemption. I would appreciate if somebody on this board could send me a written letter explaining to me why we do not qualify.
Well, I believe that I could do that. Or one of us could. And the our revenue gentleman has said that he would help us with that. Could you leave your name, address, maybe, and stuff?
You could mail a letter to VFW Post 4210, Box 307, Forest Lake, zip code 55025, and just mark attention bills. And
Mr. Olson, could you sign in? By the way, I get in trouble for forgetting to remind people on that sheet right there, as so we have a record of who testified. Thank you. Anybody else would like to come up? Come on up, Don.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your full name for the record and remember to sign in there before you head out.
My name is Don Cochin. That my Social Security was going up a little over 4%. I've lived in my house for 39 years. I have a gravel road. I have my own water. I have my own sewer. And then I get my tax bill, which goes up over 10%. I was born in the state of Minnesota, resided here except for 5 years when I was in the Marine Corps, serving my country. And it's just like you get to the point where you think that the state of Minnesota does not want us here anymore. They're trying to force me out of my home because I'm getting to the point where I can't pay my taxes anymore. When it goes up to this, like I said, I live on a gravel road. I have my own water and sewer, and my tax is over $2,000 a year. Something's wrong with this situation, folks. I made my point. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Cochin? Thank you very much. Anyone else in the audience? Mr. Carlson, welcome to the committee. Thank you for coming out tonight. It's a little cool out there for December, isn't it?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it. Members, I just want to correct a few misimpressions that the committee was possibly left with on the earlier discussion about how the Truth in Taxation Notice and the information that's available through that process. Ms. Baker and the others are correct that the notice no longer includes as much information as in the past. It used to be four columns. The furthest left was the tax in the prior year. Furthest right is the tax proposed for the current year. That is still on the Truth in Taxation Statement. The only thing that's missing is the intermediate columns that identify how much of the change is due to factors other than spending and how much of the change is due to spending. So although you cannot tell the reason why, you certainly can identify from the current statement how much of the tax change is occurring at the county level, how much of the tax change is occurring at the city level, how much of the tax change is occurring at the school district level and at the special district level. The percentages aren't on the statement, but the amounts, by simply comparing the two amounts for the 2 years, allows you to derive that information. There was further discussion about the lack of budget information, and I just want to clarify for the committee that for any city or school district that is required, or excuse me, for any city or county that is required to hold a Truth in Taxation hearing, they must publish an ad occupying at least 1/8 of a page of a newspaper of general circulation that has exactly that information in it. The budget in the prior year, the proposed budget for the coming year. So that information is available, and I would also suggest that for anybody who comes to the hearing, that information is usually made available at that hearing. Plus, frequently, it's also available on the city and county's website. So in conclusion, I just want to make sure that the committee understands the current status of the information available through the truth and taxation process. It may not be quite as good as in the past, but as your staff suggested, some thought that it was possibly exceeding, that it was creating information overload. The comparison that many people seem to be concerned with tonight is available through the current process.
So, Mr. Carlson, when I look at this truth and taxation, it has the, like here it has Ramsey County, and then column A, 05 payable, the 05 tax actual, and then 06 tax actual, but at the top, the value, the total market value goes from 240 to 300. I think that would be, that part maybe would be a little confusing as far as what portion was attributable to the increase in value versus the spending. I'm not sure how you would deduce that.
Mr. Chairman, you're correct.
Mr.
Again, the intermediate columns that were on the statements a few years ago allowed you to derive that information, but many suggested that taxpayers simply did not understand the distinction. If the legislature's desire is to reinstate that concept, you're obviously free to do so. But as far as comparing the county tax in the prior year, the county tax in the current year, that information is there. The same is true for the city, school district, township, special districts.
I see. Any other questions for Mr. Carlson? Thank you very much. Anyone else in the audience care to testify? Come on up, sir.
Al Waldron, I'm from Lindstrom, Minnesota. I could follow up a little bit on what John Hagen said and talking about sales ratio analysis. Before the meeting tonight, I did call and check with the Department of Revenue on the sales ratio for the city of Forest Lake. It's 2004, it's the most current one. There were something like 320 residential properties sold. The range of the sales analysis is from 51%, so in other words, the appraisal was, assessment was 51% of actually the sale price, up to a high of 113%. And just for the people of Forest Lake, I picked at random four homes, but we'll just look at two of them. One of them sold for $290,000 in 04, and the 205 tax paid on that was $1,600. Another one sold for $270,000, in other words, $20,000 less. The 205 tax on that was $2,500. In other words, the person who bought paid less for the house paid $900 more in taxes in Washington County in 04.
And that doesn't sound fair and uniform to you?
It is not fair. It is not uniform. It does not meet the Minnesota Constitution, you know, Article 10. It's just not there. And this is consistent. I've done this for, I don't know, a dozen different localities over a time range from 201 to now, and they're all in that range. The range is always double from the low to the high. We can look at these properties again. All four that I looked at, the sales ratio was from 66% to 113. The four that I looked at all received 7% increases for 06. So in other words, there was no correction.
Right.
Now, and when you increase on a percentage basis, the one that's highest to begin with gets the highest increase, so that $900 spread will increase rather than decrease. Mm-hmm. This is City of Forest Lake. This information is available to any citizen who wants that information from the Department of Revenue.
And I think, sir, too, one of the things we've been told is that this would be difficult to get more accurate without spending a lot more money on the process. And, you know, that's one of the things that we hear because of they're using the mass appraisal process to do it. I mean, it's easy to pick on the assessor, but what are your feelings on something like that?
Well, I agree with Marlo. The system is broken beyond comprehension. It's just, if they can't do it better than double, and this is every jurisdiction I've looked at, in Washington County, Chisago County, and Ramsey County, every one of them is double. If they can't do better than that, then the system needs to be changed. We cannot, citizens cannot pay those issues. The other thing I looked at, Chisago County, again, where I live, there were something like 375 delinquent taxpayers, you know, on the list for 04. The smallest amount on that list is $2.20. They're on the list for $2.20. If they don't pay that $2.20 in something like 4 years, the state can take the property. It's absurd, particularly when you've got some taxpayer in the city of Forest Lake paying $900 more than another taxpayer for the same value property. The system needs to be changed. It's not a matter of modifying it. It's not tinkering it. It's not exempting the Legion or someone else. It's complete reform, a complete different system. The property tax system came to the U.S. with the Pilgrims. They wanted to hire a school teacher to teach their children how to read the Bible. And money doesn't go there anymore. But that's where the system came from.
Reason to pull the plug right there, huh?
Yeah. I mean, that's where the property tax system in the U.S. came from. And there's reason for local control of spending, local raising of funds. But the system we have, the assessors cannot obviously do it. I've looked at St. Louis County. The spread there was 40% to 180%. You know, four times in terms of range. It just doesn't work. I don't mind paying my fair share, folks, but I've been in this mix on my own. So this is not strictly for the county's benefit. It's for my benefit also, and it doesn't work.
Okay. Would anyone,
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Krenke?
Certainly most of the members of the legislature understand how absolutely complex, convoluted, and unmanageable this system truly is. The difficulty is that when you look at trying to totally change the system, you run into a tremendous amount of resistance from all corners. The feeling is amongst so many people is that the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know, and that's what we face. I had a I can't remember how many years ago now, I think it was at least 5 or 6 years, a constitutional amendment that would abolish ad valorem taxes in the state of Minnesota so that we would get rid of the property tax system totally. I don't even think I was able to get a hearing on the legislation, so you can imagine how much support it had. When we had the change to the truth in taxation statements this year, survey property owners as to their either support or opposition to levy increases. I don't believe there was a single city, county that supported that legislation this year. So it gives you some idea, ladies and gentlemen, how difficult it is to try to change the system. It's not that we don't want to change it. It's that there are a lot of people out there that don't want to change the system. So whether it's the idea of a cap, whether it's Representative Vandeveer, how far did you get this year with the legislation of a cap?
Oh, the levy limits? Or the
cap?
Oh, the cap
on income.
Well, I heard it. But I think, Mr. Chair, that you might be able to finagle a way to get a hearing on any bill of prior you wanted to now.
But then we have that other group called the State Senate. So again, then we have yet another obstacle. It's called the governor. So anyway, Mr. Hammerson's right. We constantly hear, we do have meetings, but the ability to get this group, 201 legislators, to actually make a substantive change will take all of you plus your friends and neighbors to come down and say that you demand the change.
If I may.
You may.
I would suspect 99% of the people in the state of Minnesota do not know the range in this sales ratio. It is not broadcast. It is not. I've tried to get it in the Pioneer Press. I've tried to get it in the Forest Lake newspaper. I've tried in Chisago County. I've tried, and nobody will print it. The people don't know. And you're right. This devil changing is true. But if they actually knew the size of the free lunch and the size of who's paying for that free lunch, I think you could get enough support to get your change. So part of what you have to do is get that information out. And that's maybe on my shoulders to some degree. I'd like to do help on that. But to try and get even our two local papers, Chisago or one in Lindstrom and one in Forest Lake, to print anything on that, dead end. I mean, I've got hard data, and it just doesn't want to get there.
Well, and that makes sense. I mean, there's... but it is extremely difficult to make any changes. We've made some very small ones, and most of them nobody understands, and that's the only reason that they ended up passing. But I really appreciate you coming out today, and appreciate your testimony. We got pretty ambitious reform program in property tax and in taxes in general, and we have, I think, people willing to do it, but it's only one committee, and it's only one house of the legislature, so and we've been successful with getting some reforms through the house, but then there's that other little group on the other side of the hall that doesn't always like what we do, so.
Well, thank you so much for letting
me. Mr. Chairman, that's not everyone on the other side of the hall.
Go through the chair, please, Senator Bachman.
But
that's true. Yes, sir, please.
Rick Olsen, Chisago County. When Al Walgren says that he has hard data, he has hard data. Commissioner Monsk and I have met with Al a number of times, and Al single-handedly with another citizen have caused us to almost reevaluate half our county. It's been, our county's been working with the Department of Revenue, the sales ratio. He's brought up some very legitimate concerns. We've been addressing them, not to his satisfaction, but I believe we are addressing the problem. And it was particularly hard in the Lakes area. With that 30% evaluation, it's very true. Those properties were just climbing, and the evaluations were not keeping track. So it is a fairness issue, and
I do think, Commissioner, that Representative Nelson had something to do with that, too.
Well, that's good, because I think we're on track again.
That's good to hear. Anybody else in the audience? Please come on up.
Sometimes don't even know how to approach you
because we don't know how to articulate the questions, let alone understand the answers. And maybe a little bit in the marketing department, how to take what you do and boil it down into pictures, maybe, so that we can disseminate that at different levels of government and all work together so that we're not fighting each other.
Thank you so much. Any questions? Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, what Councilmember Pearson was saying, I think as we're drawing to a close on our meeting, and like we did in Fairmont, I think it's real important that the everybody in the audience, you have your packet, and Mr. Fortman went through it. And page 9 does a pretty good succinct job of letting you know that while they're related, they aren't. The difference between the assessed valuation of a piece of property being one subject, the tax rate being imposed to cover different units of government's budget being another item. And while they, again, are certainly intertwined, they do stand alone, and they do each individually directly impact what it costs the taxpayers. To the city of Lindstrom, and Councilmember Pearson, I know you're only one of five, but I know that my last year as mayor in Lindstrom, the taxpayers, their percentage that went to the city of Lindstrom was only 18.2%. I know from my tax statements and that of my 93-year-old father, it's a great deal more, and that's the point I'm making. The amount of spending that counties or cities do is the biggest impact. The closer to home the decisions are made, the more impact they make on our day-to-day lives.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Nelson. And there is another point. People say that the state should make these taxes lower or pay these people's taxes. But we have, just since I've been there, reduced property taxes a number of times, only to see them back up within a couple of years. And what ends up happening then is we're going to increase taxes down there to come back and pay for spending that isn't the state's, because the property tax simply is not the state's tax. And we don't spend locally. So we have, the more we buy it down, the less accountability that we have between taxpayer and the local unit of government providing the service. It's a difficult thing to have somebody else pay, another part of government pay for what other government is spending. And that, I think, provides confusion, but it also provides an incentive for whoever is having their services paid for to be maybe a little less concerned about how much they cost. So these are some of the issues. Is there anybody else that wants to testify? Any comments from members? After we do any editorializing. Okay. First of all, we have one other dignitary that came in. That's my wife, Camille, to recognize her. And I want to thank all of you for coming, Chairman Greenby, Representative Seaman, Representative Simpson, and Nelson and Lanning, and Senator Bachman. Especially, you know, we look at Representative Lanning and Simpson. Quite a drive to get down here. It's quite a ways too. So a lot of these people have traveled, and I think it shows their commitment and to reforming this process. And I'm very grateful to you for coming tonight. And I do want to thank the Legion for allowing us to use this room. I think it's a great format to have our meeting in. So we're very grateful to them also. With that, members, we are adjourned.
Oh, I forgot.